From SBR News, this is Inland Journal. I'm Doug Nadvornik. The 2026 legislative session in Olympia was a short one, but in many ways it was more consequential than other longer sessions. There was the passage of the income tax for millionaires and a variety of other intensely debated issues. Public Radio's state government reporter Sarah Mises-Tan will join Owen Henderson to offer her impressions. Spokane School and Parks officials say a new Adams School and Park in Indian Trail are at the top of their 2026 construction agenda. We'll hear about what else they'll be working on. Spokane author Kathy Colquitt has written about how to be an effective advocate for older adults and other vulnerable people. Colquitt has published a new book that provides practical information about how to prepare so you can be ready when you need to act. Hear those stories on this week's Pledge Drive edition of Inland Journal. Washington's legislative session wrapped up in Olympia last week. It was just 60 days long, but it was packed. State House members held a 25-hour-long debate about the so-called millionaire's tax, but they had other priorities as well. Sarah Mises-Tan reported news from the Capitol for public radio stations. She joins Owen Henderson for a recap.
Welcome, Sarah. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
So let's get it out of the way. We'll start with the millionaire's tax. Washington currently does not have any income tax, but that's sort of about to change. Can you give us an overview about how many people it could affect and what exactly the tax will do?
Sure. Just the baseline facts of it. This is a tax on income over $1 million. So just to be clear, the first million that you make in Washington State, if you are lucky enough to make that first million, is not going to be subjected to this tax. In very simplistic terms, we've been saying that it's about a dime for every dollar that you make over $1 million. This is not a tax on assets. So if you have a $1 million home or if you sell one, you are not going to be subjected to this. If you are a pass-through entity, you won't be subjected to it. Basically, if you are filing over $1 million in household income, that is who is going to be affected by this. It's estimated to generate about $3 billion annually from about 20,000 households across the state. So as proponents like to say, I think it's about like half of 1% of all Washingtonians.
Alongside this tax, passing a supplemental budget was a big point of contention. I think it's safe to say there are a lot of people disappointed on both sides of the aisle with the spending plans that did pass. So who were the biggest winners and losers, so to speak?
Overall, even Democratic leadership would admit that the budget that they passed for this supplemental budget year is absolutely going to be disappointing to a lot of people. They said that they were dealing with a lot of budget challenges this year, inflation being one of them, rising legal costs from mounting lawsuits against the state being another, and the last one being program cuts from the federal government. You know, you could say maybe it was a win or maybe it's a sigh of relief for folks who are low income and folks who are non-citizens but in the country legally. The state will be stepping in to fill the gap on things like food assistance and health care there. So those will not be cut in the budget. I did hear from legislators that they felt that we might have a humanitarian crisis on our hands if they did make those cuts. So that's the reasoning behind those being saved. What ended up getting the chop was essentially early education programming and specifically funding for a subsidy program for childcare called the Working Connections Program. Those two combined made up about a third of the budget cuts that happened. So some pretty intense cuts, essentially, for folks who are using childcare subsidies and folks who have kids who attend transitional kindergarten in the state.
One bill that would have a pretty big impact here in the inland part of the Northwest restores funding for wildfire programs. Millions were cut from that budget last year. Now it's partially back. How much will that actually bring in and what will it be used for?
Yeah, so this budget does still include about $360 million in cuts from wildfire mitigation. But actually, some small good news is that the state had been looking at pulling from something called the Climate Commitment Act to fill some budget gaps. After a lot of opposition, they decided that money from this, about $60 million from this act, is instead going to go toward wildfire mitigation, as asked for by the Public Lands Commissioner.
So there were also several bills that pushed back against the federal government's immigration crackdown. One of those is a bill that's gotten a decent amount of airtime already to ban law enforcement officers from wearing face masks when interacting with the public. Tell us more about that and where things stand.
Yeah, so that actually has passed through both chambers. It hasn't been signed by the governor yet, but it's expected to in the next few weeks. This is a bill that had a similar bill in California that preceded it, but the California bill has encountered a lot of court challenges because it only applies to federal law enforcement officers. Washington's bill does apply to both Washington state law enforcement officers and federal law enforcement officers. So there's hope that it may not encounter the same court challenges in that realm. And of course, another somewhat related bill to protect immigrants was a bill to protect workers from immigration officer audits. Workplaces are now required to give about 36 hours heads up to their workers if they are going to be audited by immigration officials.
You know, bringing us back to law enforcement briefly, another bill that got a lot of attention was one that set certain eligibility requirements for some law enforcement leaders and would give the state a pathway to removing elected sheriffs from office under certain circumstances. Testimony on the measure was contentious, to say the least. But now it's waiting for the governor's signature. So walk us through what happened and where we are now.
Yeah, so right now this law creates stricter guidelines for elected sheriffs and police chiefs. This would up the requirement of time that someone had to be a law enforcement officer before being allowed to be elected as a sheriff or a police chief. This was extremely contentious, as you mentioned, but sheriffs are going to be pushing on the governor as he goes to sign it and looking for him to veto parts of this bill. So we'll have to keep following that to see.
Well, now that the session is over, what will you be watching? What are you paying attention to?
Yeah, so there are definitely a number of bills that will probably be picked back up next session. There was a bill about folks gathering signatures for ballot initiatives. I think we will definitely see that one return as conversations continue around the state's ballot initiative process. And also, I think we're going to be looking forward to more of our state's response to the federal government as those happen. I know that in particular, leaders mentioned that they'd probably be looking at a jobs creation package or some legislation around jobs creation, as they've been concerned about how President Trump's tariffs are impacting the state's economy.
That's Public Radio state government reporter Sarah Mises-Tan talking with SBR's Owen Henderson. Some of Spokane's schools and parks will be construction zones this summer. The school district and parks department are starting to spend money authorized by voters last November. This week, Superintendent Adam Swinyard and Parks Director Garrett Jones unveiled the first wave of projects. For the school district, project number one is a new Adams Elementary School. Crews have been demolishing the old version built in 1909 to prepare the site for a new school.
We're also going to be continuing the process of modernizing North Central High School. So the next phase of that project will be happening as part of phase one. Another example of a project is the all-weather field system that will be going in across our community. All-weather fields with lights. We've got historic demand for participation both in youth and adult rec. These fields are going to extend the day and extend the season so we can get more activation.
Also in phase one, construction of the district's new trades high school. For the Parks Department, the 2026 project list is long. Garrett Jones says the big project will be construction of a new Meadow Glen Park at the north end of Indian Trail. Beyond that, he says, crews will be doing smaller projects in several locations.
Restrooms, playgrounds, sport courts. Number of different restroom renovations across the system. We're actually going to the public too right now in neighborhoods. Westgate Park is a great example. We know that you're going to want a new playground, a new restroom, but as far as a phase one, what is that top priority? So we're asking the neighborhood, would you want to see the restroom improve first or that playground improve first?
There are parking lot repairs planned in places like Riverfront Park and the Southeast Sports Complex. Crews will fix pathways in Franklin Park. They'll fix pergolas and roofs at places like the Japanese Gardens and Liberty Park.
And then other great investments, whether it's the disc golf course at Highbridge Park, Beacon Hill and Camp Sicani with the trailhead, new parking, trail access, connections to the Centennial Trail. Again, investing in one of the largest regional hubs around outdoor recreation and downhill mountain biking. And then also irrigation work. Believe it or not, we have many irrigation systems in this system that still are manually irrigated. We're dragging hoses. We hire staff. So Cannon Hill Park will be one of those first parks that will get that new irrigation system this year. And then also a lot of planning. So again, we're setting up then what 2027 will be. So we're working with the neighborhood at Coeur d'Alene Park for what their new playground and restroom will look like. Harmon Park as a full renovation of the park in Northeast Spokane. Minnehaha, Lincoln Parks.
Jones says his department will also invest more in safety. It's now hiring several rangers to patrol and monitor parks, and it plans to add operational staff to provide more maintenance. Over the next year or so, the Parks Department and School District will combine on several projects. Those include the all-weather fields with lights that Adam Swinyard mentioned earlier. They also plan to expand the Merkel Sports Complex in northwest Spokane and begin building a new recreation center at the site of the new Madison Elementary School in Franklin Park. Swinyard says the two entities work well together.
That's probably the number one thing I hear is thank you for working together. Thank you for collaborating. Thank you for not doing things in silos. Why don't we do this in all topics? And those are good questions. I think that should be the new norm in our community is that we work together. We don't worry about who has the power, who has the control. We don't worry about territorialism. We don't worry about what zip code you live in. This is about making Spokane the best place it can possibly be.
Adam Swinyard and Garrett Jones say you can follow the progress of their various projects at their joint website, togetherspokane.org. Many of us sometime in our lives will advocate for someone, whether ourselves, an elderly parent, or someone else. About 15 years ago, Spokane resident Kathy Keppel Colcutt was looking for help for her adult daughter, Brandy.
She had cancer with a 95% cure rate and unfortunately didn't make it. From diagnosis to death was 4 months. And when she went to critical care, she turned and looked at me and said, you think they'll hear me now, Mom? Because they never listened to her. Said she was anxious to take more Ativan. And I just said, you know, it's the name of a great book you're going to write when you get out of here. And she didn't. So unfortunately, she didn't make it. So I chose to write her story through my lens.
Colcutt named her first book about her daughter's illness, Will They Hear Me Now? She has since written two other books that teach people how to advocate in a variety of settings.
Advocacy with Brandy started in October of 2008, actually, when she fell on our floor with pain in her head. So immediately you're picking her up, taking her to the car, taking her to the ER, right? Finding what's going on. They said she had a migraine, give her a shot. Unfortunately, when you keep doing that about every 5 days, it's not a migraine. Never was a migraine. And so you start have to think, how can I help her? What can I do? You know, she's the one in pain asking for help. And you're like, okay, what can I do? You know, what are the options here and so on? And I talk about those in the books with Brandy, things you don't think to do. You know, at one point they wanted her to see a neurologist. We got that appointment. It was 4 months away. So we took her to the ER one day and same song, your sed rate's up, but it's not something that we're worried about. You can go home. And I told them no. And they said, what do you mean no? I said, I'm not taking her home. Now, this is a 26-year-old who has a master's in social work and goes to courts on behalf of kids every week. So, you know, they thought she was medical seeking, looking for meds. And I just said, I'm not taking her home. And the guy's like, what do you mean? I said, I'll be back here in 5 days. So see ya, I'm leaving. And he's like, no. He comes back and he says, well, we don't have that kind of neurologist on staff. I said, that's okay. I said, I'm still leaving. He goes, no. He goes, oh, you need to see this doctor. I said, well, that's great. She has that appointment in 4 months. And when you're seeing anyone you love in pain all the time, 4 months seems like 4 million years. So anyway, they came back and they said, well, I can't have you see that doctor today, but how about in 2 days? So we went from 4 months to 2 days to see that physician. And that's what you can do. You can just keep being the voice, be the strength. When one is normally sick, they usually don't have a very strong voice. They usually look at doctors, whatever, is like higher up, and I have to listen to them, and oh, it's in my head, or whatever, you know, whatever all they are saying about it. So they actually told that to Brandy, it's all in your head. And probably about 2 weeks after that, she was diagnosed with cancer. And that's the problem. They stopped seeking. they stop looking. You know, they don't even do diagnostics. You know, she had one MRI, and that didn't show the tumor. So it just is interesting. To me, it's interesting in the medical world that it seems like back in the day, and that's not too long ago, 15, 20 years ago, they would maybe do some research or call you up. I've had doctors call me on the phone, hey, I found that. Nowadays, it doesn't seem like that happens. You're in and out, and, you know, they never follow up. I shouldn't say never, forgive me. A lot of the times, they don't follow up. So, at least from my experience.
So you were motivated to write about this, about your daughter's situation, and then about tools that people should have to be able to help them. So, I mean, what were the things that you thought were the most important things that you should write in that first book?
I wanted to write about how being an advocate during this medical crisis was helpful and things I learned, why a liaison is super important. Liaison is like an advocate's advocate, so it's the person that helps. My point about that is that you're so focused on this patient, and this my daughter in this case, right, this situation, that at home I've got another girl with special needs. She has to get off the bus from school. You know, she's 8 years old, got a husband that works. It's the meltdown of the mortgage crisis in 2009. I'm a mortgage lender. I've got all these files, people needing to refinance before they lose their job or the bank closes. Man, banks were closing day by day. So you have all that chaos. A liaison is someone who helps you with all that back noise so you can focus on what's going on in front of you with the crisis. And so I talk a lot about that, how important that role is. I'm a chaplain, a first responder chaplain. My first call was a 16-year-old girl. They didn't know how to get in her cell phone. And what I love about my toolbox is that it actually has that personal stuff. What's the cell? What's your password to your cell phone, to your computer? Do you do banking? Is there a password to get onto there? Do you have an attorney? Do you have a DNR? Do you have a will? Where are they located? Who is your attorney or your financial advisor? All of those kind of things. Because if my husband and I died tomorrow, my daughter would not know where to go or who that was. And whether you have a lot of assets or very little assets, it's still important to know. It also has grief. It goes through funerals. What would you need to do to help support somebody through that? But then also has last wishes. So like, do you want to be cremated and maybe my ashes scattered over the ocean? What are those little things that you want? It's interesting when I talk to people about both the toolbox and the book, the guidebook, they say, well, my attorney has all that. They do not. They don't have your passwords. You know, if you are sick in your house, Doug, and you call 911, if you can't get up and unlock the door, they'll knock the door down. So is there a passcode to get into the house or a gated community or the garage? A lot of times you have the key to get on the garage, but or hide a key. You know, all those kind of little things is very comprehensive. The book is very comprehensive on what you can do in those areas. And the toolbox is where you fill in the blank and you put all those things down so that someone helping you or you helping someone else, you can actually access that information.
So how do you find a liaison? I mean, did you have a liaison in your daughter's case?
No, that was the big aha. As I'm writing and remembering and learning, I'm like, crumbs, that's what I needed. I so needed a liaison. I had some friends and I would say, could you do this? Could you do that? But that's what a liaison does, right? In my visualization of a liaison, I would, let's say, Doug's my liaison. I'd say, hey, can you check the side effects on the meds she's taking? Versus I'm having to do that, right? Hey, Jordan is getting home at 3 o'clock today. Can you make sure somebody's there for her? You know, now they can delegate it or they can do it themselves. It's just a point to where I can get that off my plate and I'm still focusing on the primary thing.
So don't be afraid to ask your friends to do stuff for you.
Correct. But more importantly, ask a friend to be the point that everybody can do the stuff and get back to them, then your only contact is that one friend. You don't want 10 others that were delegated something to come to you. Because maybe it was a really bad day. You know, maybe all of a sudden her blood, like with Brandy, her blood pressure stopped. You know, we're looking at maybe taking her off the vent and so on. I don't want 10 people coming to me. But that one person can come to me when it's appropriate, right? You're just simply helping that person gather that information or do the task. And it's done. So I think that's what's important about a liaison. Not that you have 10 friends out there coming to you, that you have one person they're going to, and that person is delegating out.
When I think about advocacy situations, I think about facing big nameless bureaucracies and trying to find information that will lead to, you know, this opens this door, this opens this door. Have you run into those sorts of situations where you've got to do a lot of work in order to be able to get to the answers that you're looking for?
Yes, in some cases that's very true. Some cases it's easier. So one thing I learned when Brandy was in the hospital is that you can have what's called a case conference. Nobody in the hospital, nor the social worker, who we only saw at admission 4 months earlier, had ever mentioned this. So a friend of mine who was a hospice nurse at the time had said, you know, you can have this. I said, no, what is that? All your doctors have to come into the room at the same time. Everyone has to be present. Back then, there was no Zoom, and so it was phone or in person, but they had to be present by law. And so we had that, and you have to do it in a reasonable amount of time. It took them 9 days. I understand she was already in critical care at that time and only survived 3 weeks. So 9 days was almost half the time. So, but you can do that. People don't know you can do that, you know, and know what's going on. That's very important to try to get through that system. Same thing, going to the ER, the bureaucracy is they want you out. They want you in, they want you out. They want you in, want you out. And you're like, no, she's 26. I have no right to say I'm leaving her. She's 26, you know, but it worked is my point. So you do have to push back. Our daughter that we adopted, love her dearly. She's a special needs child from day one. And we had 28 specialists in 3 years. The schools are really hard to work with when you have a special needs child. Sadly, they might feel they're open and willing, but no, talk about bureaucracy. You really have to fight. And fight doesn't mean be mean. It means you have to learn, you know, little honey to get what you want on this side. And other times stand up and just be bold and say, no, absolutely not going to happen. So you just have to have that strength. A lot of times when you're in the crisis, you don't have that strength. So it's nice to have the advocate to do that for you, to be your words. No judgment. It's not my journey. It's their journey. It was always my daughter's journey, not mine. So whatever she needed, that's what I would help get.
So you've written 3 books about this. Are we getting any better at being collectively advocates for the people we love?
Well, let's hope so. It's a new journey for me. My daughter passed 16 years ago, but it took me 15 years to write the book. So I've been into this for about 18 months now with the first book and then the last two that just went. So my intention is to go around. I want to go be a speaker all over the world if I can, but definitely in the U.S. I want to share about advocacy. I want to have workshops with my workbook so that people can actually learn filling in. You know, have you ever done a will? And it's emotional, isn't it? It's you have to have a lot of thought to that, and it takes time. At least that's my experience, and I've done them a few times. So this is similar. The toolbox is similar. You have to think about that, you know. And then also, where are you going to keep it? It's got really private information in there and stuff. So anyway, I want to do workshops. I want to help people, help them, help themselves by filling that out, and share about the guidebook. I just think it's a great resource to have. I wanted to add value to someone's life. How cool is that?
What have you learned going through this process?
That's a great question. I've learned that I advocate all the time. It doesn't matter if somebody's coming out of a door and needs a door open, I open it. And I say that, and then people are like, yeah. No, I'm saying it doesn't happen a lot anymore. I would love more kindness. And I think caring and wanting to change the world to a better place, it at least is a positive path versus a lot of the other stuff that's out there. And that's the path I choose to take. So sadly, my daughter's passing has given me the avenue to actually talk about advocacy, which I've done my whole life. And I love that. I think if we could have everybody decide to be an advocate somewhere in their life, what a much better world we would have.
That's Spokane author Kathy Keppel Colcutt. Her latest book is Effective Advocacy, a guide for medical, legal, financial, seniors, military, and more. Inland Journal has a long history at Spokane Public Radio. I created it in the mid-1990s as a place to present long-form regional programming, different than the top-of-the-hour newscasts you hear every day. Take last week's program. I was fascinated that members of the Washington State House would debate for 25 consecutive hours a state income tax for millionaires. So I thought, we have access to the tape. Why don't we condense 25 hours into 28 minutes?
The good member from the 35th District, for what purpose do you rise?
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. A motion to postpone the bill indefinitely.
Thus begins the marathon debate on the so-called millionaire's tax.
Mr. Speaker, Washingtonians have been contending with a regressive, outdated tax structure for 93 years, and I believe that we have postponed this tax reform for long enough.
One of the missions of Inland Journal is to give you the chance to hear elected officials who spend taxpayer money and make public policy. We talk with non-electeds, too. Last fall, Eliza Billingham brought together three people to the studio to debate the concept of housing first.
Today's episode is on housing first. And housing first is an approach to getting people off the streets by prioritizing getting them housed before anything else. SPR hosted Jonathan Malahan, Phil Altmaier, and Simon Morby to discuss the possible merits and shortcomings of the approach.
And so you're taking drug addicts, people that are using, and the philosophy is, I put them in a house, and all of a sudden they stop using. And they're going to be able to think clearly now, make good decisions. Do our listeners understand even who gets to go to the front of the line to be chosen to go in?
It was a riveting discussion with knowledgeable people who talk about what they do. Last summer, we aired a three-part series about local media and the challenges they're navigating.
We want to be constantly informed of what's going on. So I think our biggest change in broadcast has been how much more quickly we're putting out information, because we know that people are getting it in a bunch of different ways. I always use the example of, I'm really part of our target audience as far as news viewers. And most of the time at 6 o'clock, I am not at home in front of the TV. I'm driving kids around. I'm running errands. I'm, you know, at sports games usually. And I still want to be informed and I want to be connected. So I think the biggest change in broadcast is the demand for that.
Inland Journal is a place where you can meet interesting people doing interesting things.
My name is Hannah Van Kara. I'm a nurse here in Spokane. I've been wanting to serve in the military as a flight nurse for 4 years now. And I started that process back in 2021, but it's been complicated to try to join because I'm missing a leg below the knee. And I went to my congresswoman after being denied accession into service. And we started a bill in Congress together to try to change those standards for amputees trying to join if they can pass all the fitness tests required.
And Inland Journal is a place where you can learn about the history of the region. Questions like, how did Washington become such a mecca for apples?
And what these early frontier nurserymen had was knowledge. They weren't selling cider or apples. They weren't selling seeds. People that came out on the Oregon Trail and then later by train wanted to plant apples that had a purpose. And so the nurseryman was their expert, and he could tell them exactly what they needed.
Inland Journal is exactly what public media are all about. We bring you stories and people that help you learn more about your community and your world. It is worth your financial support. At a time when public media no longer receive public funding, your help is more important than ever. Please consider making a gift to SPR News and Inland Journal. Go to SpokanePublicRadio.org and click on the red donate button. You can help ensure Inland Journal and SPR News will continue to be a source of reliable information for the community. Inland Journal is heard Thursdays at 12:30 and Saturdays at 2:30, or online anytime at SpokanePublicRadio.org. I'm Doug Nadvornik.